You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you listen to or subscribe to the show on iTunes, please leave us a five-star rating there if you'd be so kind. Also, I invite you to join the show on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow us at Diggin' Oak Island. We're going to talk tonight about 2 hours of Oak Island material, brand new Oak Island material this week, with a new episode of the Digging Deeper specials and also this week's episode of the show itself. But before we do that, let's begin this podcast by answering some emails and some messages. We'll start with a message from Carla. Carla writes to us, "My question is, if the Laginas are that close to revealing Templar treasure, wouldn't the Freemasons try to stop them, or the government for that matter?" Well, for one thing, Carla, any answer to this question can be directed to Oak Island researcher and current search team member Charles Barkhouse. Charles, as you might know, is a Mason himself. You can probably glean that from the hat he always seems to wear. Besides the current premier Oak Island historian, Charles is also the chair of the Friends of Oak Island Society, which conducts tours around the island for the public in the summer months. For some Freemason conspiracy theorists, though, Charles is either the designated Masonic mole on the island placed there by the clandestine hierarchy of the Masons to ensure their secrets are never found, or he is the one who truly knows the scoop and is directing all of this from behind the scenes for the Masons. Or maybe he's both of those things, I guess. I'm not really sure. In all seriousness, I am not a Freemason conspiracy theorist by any means. And your question seems at least to kind of try to start me down a path of conspiracy that I'm really just not all that comfortable with. Meaning, when it gets right down to it, I do not believe that anyone alive knows what actually happened centuries ago on Oak Island and is just sitting back watching the show and laughing like a Bond villain. Having said all that, and I don't mean to be tongue-in-cheek about it, but having said all that, the government is very capable of stepping in here. And in fact, they already have on many occasions. In more recent history, in 2011 to be exact, the Nova Scotia legislature passed a bill called the Oak Island Treasure Act, which essentially granted a license to the Laginas to dig and recover treasure on the island. A license which I believe is unique in Canada, meaning they made a special exception just for Oak Island. The Oak Island Treasure Act basically puts into law the parameters for how the Laginas can legally recover any treasure. In 2014, the legislature amended the act basically as a way of protecting any historical finds, artifacts recovered in the process of searching for, you know, gold or silver or some other kind of monetary treasure. In that amendment, the legislature required that the Laginas hire and pay an archaeologist to oversee all their activities, and that's why Laird Niven is now on the team. He's not there because Rick and Marty desperately wanted an archaeologist around, though I can't say for sure they were against the idea. Laird's there because the Canadian government required it. Besides that stipulation of needing to hire an archaeologist, the law also says that if they do find treasure, they shall, quote, deliver possession of such coins and gold and silver bars recovered as are selected by the archaeologist, the value of which must not exceed 25% of the value of all the coins and gold and silver bars recovered within the area covered by the permit within 2 years of the issuance of the permit to the museum or to any other public institutions, la di yada 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 yada. You get where we're going here. It's a strange law, honestly. And if I'm reading it correctly, it seems to put a cap on how much the Laginas would have to turn over to the government, but not a floor. It also seems to put Laird Niven in the driver's seat here, you know, when it comes to divvying this out and making this decision. Now, this 2014 amendment was really a good thing for those of us more interested in the history than the treasure, and it was directly, directly a result of the show's popularity. As things like Spanish coins and, military artifacts and all that kind of stuff began to be found and put on the air in this popular show, I would imagine there probably was quite a bit of pressure on the Canadian government to make sure that these two Americans weren't allowed to just tear the place apart and keep everything they found, no matter what its possible historical significance. Just as an example of this, if the famous cross is indeed a Templar artifact and it means the Templars came to Canada long before anyone had ever thought. That cross becomes, essentially, a national treasure. And you see where I'm going here? And more importantly, this stops the Laginas and any future diggers from just digging and destroying without care for what might be in their way, you know, and what might end up getting bulldozed in the process. You see, the government can always play a role here. All they got to do is pass a bill. Thanks, Carla. Great question. Thanks for listening. On to the next. Brian writes, love your podcast. Keep up the good work. I've binge-watched the first 7 seasons in a few weeks. Good for you. I've noticed a huge difference in Rick from season 1 and season 7. He was excited and optimistic early in the shows. He now seems almost emotionless. He was truly the soul of the show and the search. Now he just shows up, nods, and says, let's explore it. Do you agree with this observation? If so, there are obviously a lot of reasons this would be the case. He's tired, worn down, frustrated, going broke, etc. But I'm theorizing Rick knows the outcome of the money pit, doesn't like it, and is kind of going through the motions now for the TV show. He even made a comment that, quote, finding out the story is as important as the treasure, unquote. It's even been a slight role reversal for Rick and Marty. Marty is now more of a cheerleader. Just curious if you see the same thing and your thoughts on this change. Thanks. First, let me address that bit about Rick thinking that the story is more important than the treasure. I feel like Rick has always felt that. So I don't think that's really a change here. I think Rick always found the history of this to be the real treasure and all that. But, Brian, truth be told, there's no way for me to be able to answer a lot of what you ask with any authority. I'm not on the island. I don't know the Laginas personally, so it's impossible really for me to say. I know Rick had a bout with Lyme's disease a couple of summers ago. That might have had some effect during those seasons. Also, you know, he's 9 years older now. And between the work he's doing on the dig and the popularity of the show and what that must have, I can imagine it probably gets exhausting. I'll say this, though. Of the people I've spoken to who have been on the show and working with Rick over the last season or two, none have reported anything unusual. So this really could just be kind of in the fact that the show has, you know, more people on it than it did during those first 1 or 2 seasons. In season 1, this was really the Rick and Marty show. Now it's the Rick and Marty and Craig and Gary and Dave and Charles and Laird and Terry and Doug and Billy and Jack Begley show. You know, with all that factored in, the screen time for one individual is inevitably going to lessen as a result. And those people I mentioned before who have worked with Rick and spoken with Rick also unanimously say, to a man, that both Rick and Marty are conducting this in the most honest way possible. So the idea that he knows the truth and is keeping it hidden for whatever reason is just not something I can entertain. It's just not even an idea I can register with. Here's what I know about Rick from everyone I've talked to who met and worked with him. He couldn't care less about anything here except for finding what was buried below the ground in Oak Island and finding who buried it and when. If you think that Rick cares about the show's advertisers or its ratings or anything like that, I really don't see any evidence of that, and there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. I just think that's an incorrect read on the man. Now, Brian, even though I don't have good answers for your questions, I wanted to address this, and I wanted to bring this one up because I hear this question about Rick's sort of attitude and energy levels. This question's being asked a lot, especially on social media and places like that. I see this question asked a lot. You're not alone in noticing what may or may not really be a change in Rick one way or the other. The fact is, that says a lot. We viewers absolutely love this guy. I mean, Rick Laginas is the inspiration. The man who hooked us all into this show, who's hooked us into this hunt. I know we all wish him the very best for sure. And I'm sure you do too as well. Thanks for the email, Brian. Now, finally, Robin writes us and says, hey there, want to tell you how much I look forward to your weekly podcast. Thank you very much for that, Robin. Also, I'm interested in your opinion regarding Nolan's Cross. Very timely question, Robin. I have come across a number of people dedicated heavily to researching the mysteries of Oak Island who insist that Nolan's Cross was fabricated, that the giant boulders were positioned by Nolan in an attempt to misdirect other searchers. I know he had a habit of being less than transparent about his research activities and findings, but I wonder how far he went especially insofar as knowingly recording falsified information in order to protect his stake in a search. I mean, there are some pretty significant theories that rely heavily on Nolan's cross. What's your take on this? Thanks. Well, thanks for the question. I mean, I have to say, you guys have come up with some tough ones this week, stuff that's very difficult for me to answer. I love it. I mean, these are great questions. Really gets me thinking about a lot of this stuff. Now, once again, this is really almost impossible for me to answer. And again, borders almost a little bit on the conspiracy areas that you see running around social media that I'm not really a big fan of. But I'll say this. I, too, have heard things like this on places like Reddit and that kind of stuff. But really, I don't have a lot of evidence to back it up. I can't really prove that Nolan faked the cross. I mean, even Dan Blankenship, who would have loved nothing more than to discredit Fred Nolan, you know, in public, didn't believe it was fake, not so far as I know. Also, just to employ logic a bit here, and I think it's important to do that when you're discussing these kind of things. If you were going to fake a piece of evidence on Oak Island, would you think the best way to do that would be to drag a few absolutely humongous rocks across a rocky landscape? I mean, these stones are something like 8 feet wide and 6 feet high and are estimated to weigh in the range of 10 tons or more each. I would think he would have found maybe a less backbreaking way to fake evidence than that. Also, Fred really wouldn't have been able to do this without, it's hard to believe he would have been able to do this without the Blankenships knowing that they were up to something. This is a pretty small island, and that's a pretty big project when you think about it. Now, some of this idea comes from the Nolan Blankenship feud, but some of it comes really from Fred himself. I mean, it is rather convenient that the cross does not extend to any property that Fred doesn't own. And it's definitely worth discussing a little bit of Nolan here. Nolan talked for years, literally years, about how he had this great, mysterious discovery, but wasn't going to reveal it just yet. According to Fred, he actually discovered the cross in 1982, I think, and didn't reveal it until it came out in a book by William Crooker called Oak Island Gold, which was published in 1992. So why did he keep it secret all those years? Well, as so happens to be, Randall Sullivan asked him that same question while writing his book, The Curse of Oak Island. And here is how Sullivan describes the answer. Quote, "Nolan told me he had discovered the cross and confirmed its dimensions by the end of 1982. So why had he waited until 1992 to reveal its existence?" I asked. As I found Fred inclined to do, he avoided giving me a direct answer. I had only inferred that he enjoyed keeping the secret to himself and felt sharing it with other people might diminish his pleasure in some way. So as you can see, Nolan was quite the cagey character, to say the least. I think some of his caginess, coupled with the Blankenship side of all this questioning his character and integrity during the course of the legal battles that we'll discuss in a little bit, probably is at the root of many of these conspiracy theories about Fred Nolan. But I think when it gets right down to it, I go back to what I said before. The idea of fabricating the cross really is just a stretch of the imagination when you stop and think about it logically. When people come at me with the claim that the Spanish coins or maybe even the lead cross were planted by the producers, it's hard to argue that the idea of doing something like that would be hard to pull off. It really wouldn't. I don't believe those things were planned, don't get me wrong, but at least I see how it could be done. It is not easy to see how and why Fred Nolan would decide to drag these multi-ton boulders the size of cars across the island just to make this cross, and then not tell anybody about it for a decade. Just seems tough to me. Thanks again, Robin. Great question. Gives us a lot to think about as we segue into our next segment. But before we do that, I want to thank everyone for their questions and emails. If you'd like to email me your thoughts or questions as well for us to discuss on a future show, you can do so at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Now, before we get into Season 7, Episode 10 of The Curse of Oak Island called Gary Strikes Again, an ironic name, but I'll get into that in a second. Let's discuss for a bit this great new special, Drilling Down, that debuted this week called The Great Feud. It chronicled the history behind the aforementioned decades-long hostility between Dan Blankenship and Fred Nolan. Now, there really wasn't a lot of new information here, not a whole lot I can really add to the history of it, but I'll try my best. It's worth touching on a few things just to sort of give you a better idea of what the impact of this feud really was. Dan and Fred are really the two modern legends of the Oak Island mystery. The two men really seem to have so much in common. It's amazing when you think about it. They both read about Oak Island in a magazine and tried for years to get involved in the search. Both desperately wanted to lead the search themselves and were consumed by the mystery, really. While they initially worked together, they soon became bitter rivals. These were both driven and stubborn men, to say the least, so perhaps it was inevitable that this would all lead to some kind of clash. Dan Blankenship made his first play to get on Oak Island in 1965. He was actually on Oak Island only days before the Restall tragedy. At this time, Robert Restall was leading the treasure hunt, and he was leasing the land from Mel Chapel. It was Chapel who brought Fred Nolan to the island, or at least Chapel agreed to let him on, depending on who you ask. Nolan was an incredibly well-credentialed surveyor at the time. So in 1961, Chapel granted him permission to do the first real exhaustive survey of the eastern side of the island, the side which includes the swamp, the money pit, Smith's Cove, all that stuff. Dan and Fred were both truly obsessed with the mystery, to put it lightly. And they both made a play to Chapel to succeed Robert Restall after his death, as, you know, the lead treasure hunters, the people in charge of all this. Neither were successful, at least not initially, as Chapel soon leased the land to Robert Dunfield. But after Dunfield's spectacular failure at the money pit, Blankenship's years of trying to get involved finally paid off, and he was in and started working on the island. He found a partner in a man named David Tobias. But Fred Nolan was not in. But like I said earlier, these were driven and stubborn men, and you'll see how these qualities might have come to hurt Nolan's attempts to run the show. Now, before Blankenship was ever involved, and Robert Restall was still working the island, Fred Nolan tried and tried to get Chapel to allow him to be involved in the search. Now, remember that surveying Fred did I mentioned before? It appears this was when Nolan was beginning to formulate and plot his next move, a move intended to strong-arm Chapel into letting him on the island. Fred found what was essentially a backdoor onto Oak Island by discovering what was, I guess you can call, a gap in what Chapel thought was his complete ownership of the property lots on the island. Nolan stealthily moved in and purchased 7 lots, which included complete ownership of the swamp from the family of Mrs. Sophia Sellers. Lots Chapel thought he owned. Now, listen, it's time for a little quiz. Do you remember Mrs. Sellers? She was the daughter of Anthony Graves. She was the woman who fell into the sinkhole with her oxen, and that sinkhole we now call the Cavern Pit, which we've seen quite a bit of earlier this season. Now, in the spring of 1963, Nolan took the deeds, these new deeds in his hand, the deeds to his new properties, his new lots, which he purchased for, I think, all of $2,500. He took them to Chapel, and he offered, essentially, to exchange them for the right to lead the treasure hunt at the Money Pit. Basically, Nolan wanted to force Chapel into throwing Robert Restall and his family off the island and allowing Nolan to take over. Needless to say, Chapel was appalled, and he refused, thinking he could probably just win any litigation anyway. Now, as I'm sure you can imagine, this didn't get the relationship off between all these guys on a very good foot. Chapel and the people he worked with, including Dan Blankenship, fought a years-long battle that eventually ended in Nolan retaining property rights to the land he claimed. Now, not on the basis of the property being properly attained, but instead on the basis of really the statute of limitations had run out on this claim. Needless to say, Blankenship and the others in what was at the time Chapel's team and then eventually Blankenship's team didn't really think too highly of Nolan's credibility, even from the beginning. Now, I don't want to go through all the ups and downs of this, the plenty of sensational stories and of the cantankerous living arrangements on Oak Island during the next few years when the Blankenships and the Nolans were actively searching the island and warring over literally everything you can possibly imagine. The show touches briefly on a few of the more well-known clashes, most notably the one that seems to always be mentioned, the one where the Canadian Mounted Police needed to come and confiscate a rifle from Dan Blankenship. Now, that particular story, the part that most people don't hear, that particular story might end with Dan Blankenship and his rifle, but believe it or not, it didn't begin with Dan at all. In fact, Dan wasn't even in the picture when it began. Okay, here's how it goes. In 1965, Robert Dunfield, with Chappell's permission, built the causeway, the same causeway you now see leading from the mainland to the island. They also hired an armed guard to prevent Nolan from crossing the causeway, mostly because Nolan had tried to pull this thing on Chappell with the, going behind his back to buy these properties that Chappell thought he owned. So they were, again, off on a bad foot. So anyway, they place an armed guard there, and that causes Fred to have to access his land, his property on the island, only by boat. Nolan then responded by purchasing the property on the mainland side of the causeway, and then therefore blocking that off so that Dunfield and his men could never even get on their new causeway to begin with. For a while, no one could use the darn causeway, and Bolt ended up having to boat things back and forth from the mainland. And this was before Dan was ever even involved in all this. In fact, when Dan Blankenship and his partner David Tobias, who I mentioned earlier, did take over from Mel Chappell, and they essentially brokered an agreement with Fred Nolan, offering him some cash and a few shares in this new formed Triton Alliance in exchange for access to the road and some, surveying work and that kind of thing. But as you can imagine, and you can probably tell from the fact that we had a whole special on this, this detente did not last very long. And before you know it, we have chains, gates, rifles, and then the Mounties are there. But there were certainly other squabbles. I mean, this stuff went on for decades. In fact, Fred Nolan got into it with others, not just Dan Blankenship and Mel Chappell. He got into squabbles with the Highway Department. I think that the Department of Tourism was in there as well. So it wasn't just, a Blankenship-Nolan feud that was, it wasn't just Blankenship and Chappell that Nolan was willing to go to the mattresses against. The show we saw this week was really only an overview of this quote-unquote great feud. But what I did appreciate the most about how the producers handled the story was the way in which they truly focused on what might have been had none of this had happened. Had these two men actually cooperated, these two guys so driven to get to the bottom of this, there's really no telling what they might have accomplished together. What they might have found. I mean, I know that sounds silly and maybe a little cliche, but it really is true. This feud, what we know for sure, this feud did not amount to anything positive with regards to the treasure hunt. I can certainly criticize the show for putting what I thought was maybe a bit too much of the Laginas in it, and as a result, leaving out a lot of the actual history of the feud that I think you might have found interesting. But when it comes right down to it, the Laginas played an enormous role in the final chapter of this story. Rick's amazing ability to essentially end this feud, to bring Fred Nolan and his family into the fold, is not something that should be taken lightly by any of us. The direct consequence of this feud is that the only thing that really suffered was the hunt. But that seems to be behind us now, and that can only be a good thing. Both men did incredible work on the island, and now the current team can tap into all of that in their search, all of that research, all that information, all that stuff they gained over the years. And that could really only be a positive. I also wanted to mention something else about this edition of Digging Deeper. The home movie footage shown in the first segment, showing the work being done in color by the Restalls, was absolutely fascinating. Just wonderful thing to see for an Oak Island nut like myself. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned how I agreed with Rick when he said that the work at the wooden box-like structure they found earlier this season, Smith's Cove, looked like something the Restalls might have built. Go back and look at this footage we're talking about and take a look at it closely again, and you could see exactly what Rick and I mean by this. If for no other reason This footage is enough to make me want to watch this episode of Digging Deeper again and again. The producers hardly ever get credit from me, but let me give it here. This was a real treat. Now let's get on to discussing the episode. As I mentioned before, this week's episode was titled Gary Strikes Again. Which I have to wonder what they were thinking here. I mean, as you'll see, this name was not only had a little touch of irony to it, but also seems to be, I don't know, maybe a little bit of needling Mr. Poor Gary Drayton. Well, let me explain. I'll get to that in a minute. The episode begins with a team working in Smith's Cove by the giant timber they found last week in the ground, right in front of the slipway. They bring in archaeologist Laird Niven to have a look, and he says that he feels it may be part of that slipway, somehow related, despite the fact that the timber here is obviously much bigger than the ones that were used to build the slipway that they had already recovered or uncovered last year. But I think what Laird is talking about is the construction method used here, and we don't really get a good look at that. It certainly seems possible to me, and what little I know of primitive slipways, that larger timbers would be used at the end of the slipway, considering it's sort of the initial point of contact with a ship. That, of course, is making the leap that this is, in fact, a slipway, which and not something else, and we can't really say that with any certainty. You can also see here an example of how little information we're getting after these discussions are edited down. I mean, Gary and Laird are talking about this being like a dog leg onto the slipway. I mean, they must have some reason to think that, but it's clearly not shown to us, as this straight giant timber wouldn't really be a dog leg of any kind. But be that as it may, Laird wants to hand dig it out, as opposed to using the excavator, to get a better look, an archaeological look. Hopefully the results of that dig will be coming soon and we'll get a really good look at what this is. Later, Gary Drayton is metal detecting in the area, literally right on top of this giant timber, and he pulls out this flat piece of metal that he goes absolutely nuts over. He thinks it's silver, calling it like a silver tag, and it does look like kind of a large dog tag, and declares that it's really old, and comparing it in age to the lead cross that they found, which dated to the medieval period. Now, he bases this conclusion on the tag's patina, basically the blackish coloring that seems to have formed over centuries of erosion, he says, at the hands of being in salt water. Now, usually Gary is right in these initial impressions, but hold on. Perhaps Gary didn't quite strike again. They call up Dr. Krista Brousseau. Now, you've seen her a million times in the show, but if you don't recognize the voice, she is the chemistry professor from St. Mary's University in Halifax, who they often take these mysterious metal objects to in order to identify sort of the chemical makeup of the island of the item and tell them exactly what's in it. She tells them that the piece is not silver, but that in fact it is lead. Cue the wah, wah, wah for poor Gary. We can all agree that no matter what the slipway really is, it was obviously built for some kind of maritime use, so finding a little shard of lead in that same spot is not at all unusual in my mind. In fact, Gary says he found it somewhat wedged under the timber, so you can easily see how it might have come unfastened from somewhere and then the tide washed it into whatever wedge it was that he found it in. At one point in the show, Gary calls lead sort of the duct tape of its time, and he's absolutely right about that. Before the modern construction techniques that we see now, lead was used for all sorts of maritime applications, so it's really not at all unusual to find it where they did. On the bright side, though, this piece can still add to the story. We've already seen on this show more than once how lead can be dated, and rather accurately, too. It's also very possible to find its origin, meaning where on the planet the lead was originally mined from. So for that, they turn, or I should say return, to a man named Dr. Chris McFarlane, a professor of earth sciences at the University of New Brunswick. Now, we've seen McFarlane before as well. He specializes in using a process called laser ablation, which extracts little microscopic pieces of the metal from the object to identify its chemical makeup and all that sort of stuff. He most often uses this method to identify rocks and minerals, but as we saw when the team tried to identify the lead cross a couple years back, this process also works on these metal pieces as well as rocks and minerals. This process is especially good for archaeological finds because, just like this, because it does almost imperceptible, you know, damage to the artifact as it's, you know, taking pieces away. The laser truly is that precise. McFarland finds this item is not of North American origin, but of Western European, probably the Mediterranean areas in places like maybe Italy, France, or Spain. Predictably, this launches the narrator into another one of these silly soliloquies about the Knights Templar. You can see these things coming. You can see these Templar soliloquies coming at this point. It's like the punchline of a bad joke. You know a couple of beats before that it's coming at you, but there's really nothing you can do to stop it. The problem is, nothing here has been dated. So why would this be related to the Templars at all? I mean, that conclusion is absolutely beyond me from the information they gave us. McFarland gives no dating at all, only a sort of a very broad possible origin location. And before you ask, no, I'm not impressed by just the origin. Of course, ships sailing in the New World might have been built or partially built in Europe. That's true even today. There needs to be more information here to come to a conclusion and start talking about the Knights Templar. Hopefully this isn't the last of this little piece of metal. If it is, you know they didn't find much out. Hopefully Gary did truly strike again, and hopefully we'll get a Skype call from Tobias Skronik from Germany. Hopefully that conversation isn't too far off, because that usually means there's some information to impart to us, and hopefully we can get some. Also, on a little side note, McFarland mentioned how this thing contained more tin than he has ever in a lead object than he has ever seen before. I'm not sure what that means, and I tried to figure that out, but I guess it might mean something. They mentioned it a couple of times. Anyway, hopefully we have more to come here. Now let's turn just for a quick moment, short segment here about the swamp. It appears the team had finally received their permits to excavate in the swamp and really do a good dig. So Jack Begley and Craig Tester begin the process of draining out the swamp through a series of pumps. Now later on, the team is joined at the swamp by Tom Nolan, who has brought a man named John Skirka to meet with Rick and the team, some of the team. Skirka is from a company called Great Excavations Incorporated. I love that name. They specialize in what they call, quote-unquote, amphibious excavators. I mean, folks, go to their website and check out the photos of these things. These are some impressive machines. I mean, this is cool stuff. Skirka thinks he has just the gear they need to easily get out into the wet and unstable ground of the drained swamp and to do the first really true full dig of the area. His machines can basically sort of float on the wet ground and are capable of digging down to a depth of 70 feet, an incredible depth for an excavator. I can't wait to see this in action. We get a little touch of it at the end of the show, how this thing is going to work, but this is obviously just a taste of what's to come. This is going to be a big part of the next couple episodes, I would imagine. For many of us, we entered this season with seriously high hopes of a true and complete investigation of the ground under the swamp. The initial seismic testing, you remember, which indicated a possible ship in the swamp, I called it the SS Matty Blake because he was so excited about it, really came up kind of frustratingly empty. Pretty predictable when you think about it. But over the decades, so much more has been theorized about the swamp and found and pulled out of here, and maybe now we can finally get some good answers about it. Even if they end up with nothing, even if they come up totally empty and prove that Fred Nolan and everyone else who believes that the swamp has plays a big part in all this is completely wrong, I agree, is at least an achievement. It's a disappointing one, but it's achievement and it's something that we can then cross off the list. That's really all we have for the swamp in this episode. Finally, we end up at the Money Pit and this endless search to relocate the Money Pit's actual location. Quick rundown. Team thinks they've located Shaft 2. That's the second shaft ever dug on Oak Island, second only to the Money Pit. It was the first ever searcher shaft dug, and the idea was that the people who dug it dug down 14 feet away from the money pit, down to a depth where they think they were under the flood tunnels or the flood trap, the waters that had come in and flooded the money pit. And then they tried to tunnel horizontally towards the pit, hopefully bypassing the booby trap and then hitting a nice and dry treasure vault. Obviously, that failed. After being convinced that they found Shaft 2, they're now digging core drilling holes to try and locate the horizontal tunnel that I just mentioned. While waiting for the sample to come up and to be examined by geologist Terry Matheson, Dan Henske is there, and he makes a fantastic suggestion. He says something like, wouldn't it be great if we could find this tunnel and then get a camera down there to see where it goes? I mean, what a great idea. You know, Dan has been doing this a long time, and I think sometimes people forget just how smart and committed this guy is to the Oak Island search. If they do find this tunnel, they should absolutely take Dan's advice and take a good look down there before they really go too far with this. Anyway, the samples they bring up lead Terry to believe they have found a tunnel, but maybe not the tunnel they were looking for. Instead, it appears he is of the opinion that they found one of the booby trap flood tunnels themselves. But all this leads to some very confusing and honestly poorly edited conversations when Rick and Marty and Alex arrive to hear from Terry. Terry starts by calling the hole that they just drilled a quote-unquote complete success because they hit what he feels is the side of a tunnel. But go back and watch this scene again and just try to follow some of the logic that's being presented to us. The narrator had already, before the commercial break, steered us toward the idea that what they were hitting was a booby trap flood tunnel and not this sideways tunnel to reach the money pit. But Marty is talking about things coming in from the money pit. Now, remember that horizontal tunnel dug from Shaft 2 towards the money pit? They dug 14 feet away and then got 12 feet before the floodwaters burst in. So it seems that's what he's referring to, that this tunnel might have something coming in from the money pit due to flooding. And then they talk about hitting, quote-unquote, the collapse, and they offer little or no explanation to somebody who's not a true Oak Island nut of what they mean by that. I assume, and I'm pretty certain they're referring here to the famed collapse of the money pit, which they've talked about before. Now, there's some conjecture. Let me just fill in the blank here, because they mention the collapse a couple of times and don't really fill you in as to what they might be talking about. There is some conjecture as to when this collapse actually happened and who was in charge when it did, but the money pit shaft collapsed completely. What we know for certain is that sometime in the mid-19th century, all of the workings built in the shaft, all of the wood, cribbings and all that kind of stuff that they built completely collapsed and down into the money pit. Let me now, I think the best way to describe this would be to turn to the description offered by Mark Finnan in his book Oak Island Secrets. This is how he describes it. Before reaching their destination, the men took a well-earned dinner break, during which disaster struck. A loud crashing noise brought the men running to the open face of the treasure pit. When the dust and the debris had settled, they were horrified to find that the bottom of the had dropped out of the pit, causing the wooden cribbing on the shaft walls to collapse. The two chests or boxes containing the hoped-for treasure had fallen further down into the pit and now lay buried under a mountain of broken lumber. Mud and debris had also flooded into the new shaft, filling it to a depth of 12 feet. One workman, who had had the misfortune to be in the tunnel at the time of the collapse, had managed to salvage a dish-shaped piece of yellow-painted wood, which had landed at his feet as he ran for safety. This led to speculation that the treasure chest or boxes may have been swept into the connecting tunnel and ended up elsewhere underground. Now, what he's referring to when he's talking about the dish-shaped yellow painted piece in the tunnel, he's referring to this tunnel, this sideways digging tunnel that they were in. They were building, I think at the time, digging another one of these shafts heading towards the money pit. So not only could we have debris from the money pit spilled out into this original shaft 2 tunnel, we can have it spilled out into multiple tunnels. So once again, we have more variables really yet to come in all of this. If you thought that finding the location of the money pit was like driving through the toll booth before getting on that magical rainbow bridge leading to a pot of gold, I mean, you're dead wrong. If we know one thing for sure, it's that whatever and wherever the original depositors place their treasure, it ain't where they left it, and it ain't in whatever they left it in anymore. It's a subtle and sobering reminder to the Laginas of just how much farther they really have to go. So that's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. As I said at the beginning, please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you do enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. That helps to get the word out on the show. Not really sure how it does, but it does. Thank you to everyone who's done so already. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and I really appreciate the kind words. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you could do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Now, I'm on vacation next week, folks, so if I do get to post a show, which I'm not promising, it won't be until the weekend, until the very end of the week. But don't be surprised if you don't get a show at all next week. I'm going someplace warm, and I take my vacation seriously. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.